Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Welcome to Health and Safety Conversations. Here's your host, Tom Bourne.
Hi, and welcome to Health and Safety Conversations. I'm your host, Tom Bourne, and with me today is the awesome Robert Allen. Robert, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. And yourself, Tom?
Fantastic. Robert, whereabouts are you located?
Currently located in Bunbury, Southwest WA. In my humble opinion, having travelled almost everywhere in Australia, at least on the boundary of the coastline, probably one of the best spots in the country.
Why is that?
It's just so unique. I mean, there's so many beautiful places in Australia, but what's unique about Southwest WA in particular is just one, probably the isolation, and two, just the raw beauty and Mother Nature, particularly the weather patterns and the ocean.
Very good. Very good. All right, Robert, I know a little bit about you because I have done a little bit of research. But for those who haven't heard of you yet, can you tell us a little bit about your professional journey?
Well, yeah, shortly after finishing an environmental science degree, I entered the construction world as a environmental advisor, primarily looking after the construction environmental management plans. And so I started my career in that for a couple of years, and then quickly diversified into safety, being in the construction game. I saw an opportunity for myself on numerous levels. I thought there were some good growth opportunities, some good remuneration opportunities. And also, I felt it a bit exciting, like there was quite a bit to do in that space. And I was looking at the other people that were doing it, some good, some not so good, and everything in between. And I thought, I think I can give this a crack. And after talking to my boss at the time, we agreed that if I went and did the studies, I'd have a good chance at getting into that field, and which I did. So I've been in the construction industry for probably just over 12 years now, and in safety for over a decade now. And that journey has taken me on various construction projects, both private, government, mining related, all over the state. And then after working for various organizations about 3 years ago, I decided I wanted to get into the consulting game and start my own consulting business here in the Southwest WA, primarily looking at small, medium sized businesses that I could see struggle with safety, one from the compliance side of things, but also from putting it into practice. And so that's sort of my target area, those sort of businesses that probably don't have a safety advisor or a safety professional role in the organization for good reason. Probably they don't need one, but some do have a safety role. in the organization, and sometimes they need those people need a bit of assistance or maybe a bit of guidance and coaching. And then I've got a few clients where they do have a team of safety people and they need a bit of independent assistance, or, you know, I wouldn't say expert guidance, but, you know, a professional sort of person to come in and help them on their journey. So, yeah, in a nutshell, that's a brief overview, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah. What's some of the places you've worked in and around? You said you've worked in and around pretty much the whole of the state. What's some of the places you have worked?
Oh, look, I started on a project down in Margaret River, and then it's funny, I kind of went as far south and then moved north. So Margaret River, Busselton, and then I went up to Port Hedland, Karratha, Onslow, out in the Wheat Belt, projects in Perth, then back to the southwest where I've been based for the last 8 years or something like that. Although when clients have projects all over the state, and then I've got a few clients over east and Tasmania and things like that. So yeah, quite a variety and locations. And when you talk about WA and how isolated it is, and I talked about how raw it is, it's also very harsh, because some of those places, that's pretty harsh working environments. And, you know, it's a credit to those people that go and do it. And there's a reason they're paid well, is because, you know, they're flying out for however length of time it is, working in, you know, 40 plus degree heat, not doing the best jobs in the world, not in terms of the type of work, but in terms of the physical labor, the heat, all the elements they're up against, it can make or break people. So it's an interesting industry, a challenging one, and one that, yeah, it's a credit to those that can actually sustain it.
Yeah, yeah. The local council just down the road from me, I noticed the other day it got to about, I think it was about 33 or 34 degrees, and they shut the council tip down. They said it's too hot for our people and stuff like that. I'm like, imagine if they did that in the Pilbara. Imagine if they shut things down if it got to about 35 degrees. There'd be no work going for 6 months a year at least, I'd suggest.
Oh, well and truly. And sometimes it's not even the temperature that gets you. It's the humidity, you know. Mm. You know, I remember working in the Pilbara, and you're in the aircon when you're in your camp, but then as soon as you get out, you just start sweating before you even think about doing anything. And then, yeah, it's just that constant cycle of aircon, out in the field, sweat, back in the aircon. And it's actually not good for you doing that. But when you're working in an office and then out in the field as well, like, it's unavoidable. But yeah, and then you got the whole climatization, takes a couple of weeks, you know. And then if you're in and out, you know, that throws you off. So yeah, it's challenging, and you know, dealing with those elements, it's just another risk that businesses have to manage, and it, I mean, that's a challenge in itself.
Yeah. You did some, as you said, you've done some work in all around, lots of things like Karratha, Port Hedland, Margaret River, Onslow. Onslow's a lovely place. Port Hedland, I have a reason for asking you this. So. All right, for those who don't know anything about Port Hedland, can you give a brief description of, I don't know, the town, what it is, what the importance of Port Hedland is, I guess, to the economy, et cetera, anything like that?
Oh, look, I wasn't in the mining sector when I was working out there. I was actually on a construction project for Watercorp, was a client doing a wastewater treatment plant and pump station and pipeline and that. But yeah, the mining industry all through that area is massive. And Port Hedland, you know, that the name sort of alludes to what it is, but there's the massive mining port there for iron ore, I'm assuming. And the town is interesting. I was actually at a camp in South Hedland, which, yep, the camp itself was actually really nice. It was probably one of the nicest camps I'd been at. It kind of felt like you're staying in a hotel. So that was actually quite nice, and they had a sports center down the road, which is actually quite nice as well. There's some rough elements in South Hedland, which, you know, there's more to it than that. But, you know, there's obviously issues in Australia in terms with the the Aboriginals and, you know, the situation therein, which is different subject really. But Port Hedland itself, it's actually a beautiful area. But when you start talking about the Pilbara and the, you know, the wet and the dry season, it's a very harsh environment. But like a lot of the sort of mining towns, there's a lot going on. It's a bustling place in terms of mining and construction activities. And yeah, like you're so busy working when you're up there, you don't really have time to, you know, submerge yourself in the community or the surrounding environment really. Cause you know, I was up there for 3 weeks and then you get 1 week off and then you might go down to a local pub somewhere on the beach and have fish and chips and, you know, come back and that's your day. So
yeah. And I lived in Port Hedland and South Hedland in particular there for, I don't know, about a year. It's funny, and most people who have been there usually describe it in either three or two words. The last word is being whole, and you can put in whatever two words you want in front, but it's not usually complimentary, which is astounding for the amount of money that actually flows through and out of that port every single day. Yeah, all right.
Well, I actually went through Port Hedland a few months ago for the first time in, oh, I don't know, 10 years or something like that. And I thought the place actually looked a lot better than when I was there in terms of the council or shire putting some, you know, funding into the community infrastructure and stuff like that. Like it looked like there's a bit of a swing in terms of trying to like revitalize it. And it was funny going from South Hedland. The project I went to after that was in Karratha, and my assumption going to Karratha, not having ever been there before, was that it was just going to be another sort of South Hedland, Port Hedland, and it was actually a really nice community. And I was like, wow, there's like nice houses and nice buildings and restaurants and cafes, and it was a totally different feel. It was For being so similar in terms of, you know, locality and industry, it was worlds apart, which was, yeah, very, very interesting. But it was very well received on my behalf, being my next placement.
Yeah, yeah. My wife often said that if we'd been positioned in Karratha, we still probably would be in the Pilbara region You're right. Yeah, I think you kind of hit the nail on the head. It is such a nicer town. There's modern facilities, there's classy dining, there's even cocktail bars. I mean, you know, this is in the Pilbara. It's
yeah, and then I like the place. Yeah, and there's a lot of families there, and you can tell that going there. And you know, some people they love it, and like you say, once they go, they stay. And you know, there's a lot of people that love the ocean, so they've got their boats and they do their fishing, and you know, there's national parks within close range, so they can go do their camping, exploring, and there's a lot of adventures to be had up in that area. But yeah, you just got to be prepared for the wet season, I suppose, and the dry season and everything in between. So yeah, you're up against the elements, that's for sure.
All right, must be honest, I don't know much about environmental anything. So what does an environmental advisor do?
Well, it's probably much like safety in a sense, or even quality, right? So it's an area in which needs to be managed. So depending on where you are and what's going on, environmental advisor, for example, you'd be looking at things like, but you know, if you're working near a national park or something like that, you'd obviously be trying to preserve the national park and not have any impacts on that. So some of the things might be, you know, preventing the introduction of weeds and seeds and bacteria, fungi, and that's, you've also got wildlife you have to be concerned about. You've got, you know, in some areas they're water catchment areas and there might be dams that are drinking water, things like that. So, you know, you're going to be having to think about, you know, your groundwater management if you're doing excavations, erosion, sediment getting into the water. It's quite varied. Different areas, you'll potentially have acid sulfate soils. You know, you might be working in contaminated sites. So it's really different to the safety, in the sense that there's something there that you need to protect, and you need to have a management plan in place and risk assess it and actually implement it, monitor and review. So yeah, it's instead of the people, it's the environment, really, is what it comes down to.
Yeah. I must say that maybe 20 years ago, I was fairly cynical about the combination of safety and environment being put together. Used to have people who, you know, used to see people who left university with an environmental degree come out and be safety and environment officers on mine sites, and I'd be like, yeah, don't see the connection. Protecting people, protecting snakes, I don't see the connection.
But yeah, I've
become a bit wiser since then, because I don't know, the environment affects all of us in the end, doesn't it?
Yeah, but look, you're quite right. I think, you know, if you go back to my journey, and I started as environmental advisor, I was seeing people in the safety positions classes, HSE advisors with no environmental qualifications, although it is an interesting one, and there is some crossover. So inherently through safety, if you look at chemicals, you know, you're inherently already got that environmental aspect. You've got the handling of chemicals or the use of chemicals by people, which you don't want to impact the people using them, but at the same time, you don't want to impact the environment. So you kind of got inherently some environmental aspects there. And to be honest, there's a lot of low level or easily to manage environmental aspects and impacts that safety professionals can manage quite easily, right? And then even as an environmentalist, to be honest, like I was a generalist, I was no specialist in any, you know, aspects particularly. But when it comes to more in-depth environmental analysis and management, typically you'd get, you know, a professional specialized in that area or a consultancy to come in and tell you how to manage it. Anyway, some of that stuff's, you know, easy enough for a safety professional. Some of it's not. And it really depends on where you're working and what you're doing, to be honest. But yeah, there is, it is interesting. I don't think you should throw an E on somebody's title or safety unless they're actually qualified, and much like quality. So yeah, I tend to agree with you, although in a lot of these aspects, there is some crossover, and with, you know, the right training and experience, you know, you can quite easily be somewhat competent in these areas, and that's where safety, environment, and quality, you know, that they can quite easily be integrated. I mean, if you look at the management systems and the way that the ISO standards are set up, I mean, quality ISO 9001 really is the umbrella standard for management systems, and all the other ones sort of just are a substandard per se. And really, you look at the high level clauses, they're all the same. Obviously the context changes, but that's the important bit, is that the context does change, but the management systems are all set up the same, structured the same. So yeah, you can, I suppose that sort of ties into my journey as well. That's how I continue to diversify from environment to safety, and then quality as well, and seeing how they're really all the same. You're just looking at different contexts of managing the business, really.
Good. Quite a bit of environmental legislation has been introduced across most modern countries in the last 20 years. Would you say that environment and health and safety are largely compliance functions these days, or is there more of an ethical or moral part to that as well?
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting in itself. Like if you look at, you know, miners and construction companies looking at trying to start a project, there is a lot of red tape in terms of environmental approvals. You know, whether that's justified or not, I would assume to a degree it would be, or else it wouldn't be there. I don't know the ins and outs of all that bureaucratic stuff and you know, how they got to that point.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Because it's been in the pipeline for years. And to be honest, I don't really get stuck in that space too much, but I do know it is a pain for miners and contractors trying to get going with projects that are already approved and they're just waiting for certain approvals, especially being that they're government organizations that do the approvals and they can take quite a long time, especially if they get a backlog of approvals sitting on their desk. So that is a pain point for many organizations. Now, in terms of managing safety environment, in terms of it being compliance based, yes, I mean, there's many factors on why you do safety. Like, if you just talk about safety, there's a lot of reasons why you do it. One, from an ethical and moral point of view, you're going to want to look after your people, right? Like, that's just humans. Most humans care for one another, and they don't want, you know, any harm to occur on the people. But then the other aspect is you've got compliance. So, you know, you've got the acts and the regs and the whole legislative framework that you need to comply with. So that's a component. And then you've got other external factors. You've got, you might have board expectations. You know, you're going to have client requirements and expectations. So there's a lot of requirements, you know, both internally and externally, that organizations need to comply with. Now the tricky bit is actually making sure what you're doing on the ground is beneficial. And in a safety role, it's also, or a safety environmental role, whatever role that is, you know, if the majority of your time is doing compliance activities, you know, paper-based type compliance activities, and you're not actually looking at what's going on the ground, you know, you're going to have a balance where it's not balanced, basically. You know, because you need to work out where that balance needs to be for your organization, and that really differs on the organization and type of activities they're undertaking. So, and that's one of the struggles with managing it, is that you can't over prescribe on how to do it, because every organization is so different and unique. The challenge is determining how much time you dedicate to each. And then the other tricky bit is, yeah, if you do things because you legally have to, or your client, it's a client requirement, you know, you do that. But if it's something above and beyond, or you're trying to meet a legal requirement that's not overly prescriptive, the challenge there is determining what you're going to do, how you're going to do it, and how you're going to ensure that it's actually beneficial and fit for purpose. That's one of the things that commonly sort of help organizations with, is trying to find that balance. That's the bit I actually really enjoy. And sometimes it takes a while to actually strike a balance and work out, you know, what's fit for purpose, what's practical, what actually provides benefit. Sometimes that's trial and error. Sometimes, you know, you can strike that balance pretty easily. But sometimes it does take a lot of thought and review. And sometimes you just keep going around in circles till eventually you get back to the starting point where you first started and you thought, all right, well, let's just keep doing what we were doing, eh?
All right. In the last probably 10, 15 years, there's been a lot of talk about behavioral-based safety, safety one, safety two, new view safety. It's like going into an ice cream shop. You've got a million different flavors of this thing that's called safety. Is there some sort of philosophy that actually guides you in terms of your practice of safety?
Particularly anyone. It's funny. There's a post on LinkedIn about this not too long ago, and I actually provided a comment, something like, new view, old view, sideways view, upside down view, doesn't really matter as long as you're doing something to try to continuously improve. And then, you know, I took a quote from somewhere I can't actually quite remember, but it said, if you're not evolving, you're revolving. Look, I think all of those theories and methods, you know, there's probably some good points in there, but like anything, you know, in business or in life in general, everyone's got an opinion, right? You know, there's a lot of research that goes on, and, you know, there's a lot of science behind a lot of stuff. Really, what you got to do is you've got to collate all that information, analyze it, and make your own decision, really. So to me, a lot of that stuff are good resources for doing that. In terms of sticking to one and that being the answer, the theory or approach that you're going to take, to me, you'd be doing an injustice to yourself and your organization, because there's so much out there and there's so much, you know, thinking and research that goes on to this, that it's continuously, you know, evolving, that you have to be agile. You got to keep up with the times. Another one, you know, that another quote I heard that I quite like is that, you know, if you're doing what you're doing 10 years ago, you're either 10 years behind, or 10 years ago, you're 10 years ahead of time. You know, so in some instances that's perfectly fine. Things you're doing previously might be perfectly okay, but a lot of times there is opportunities for improvement. There is new ways to do things. You know, we learn new things about safety every day. I mean, if you look at what's happening with Safe Work Australia and, you know, all the work safes, there's constantly, you know, new codes of practice coming out, new exposure standards, you know, banning engineered stone. So we're always learning. And until you learn, or until you actually know of something, you know, how can you manage it in that way? Because you don't know any difference. So, yeah, to me, you really just got to keep your finger on the pulse and see what's going on out there. And, you know, and always be open to new ideas and opportunities for improve, and doesn't mean you have to utilize it, but you can think about it in your own practice and go, all right, well, that's interesting. How can we apply that here? And maybe you can't, maybe you can, but sometimes it's just that the way you think might even just help you with your own practice on, you know, oh, next time I might approach the situation a bit differently, you know. So no clear answer on that one. Sorry, Tom.
That's all right. All right. Organizational maturity. How do you determine if an organization has a mature safety program or not? I'm curious.
Well, you know, there's people out there that do it probably far better than I do. There's a lot of research and there's a lot of programs out there that are pretty well defined in terms of trying to measure that. To me, an organization sort of needs to define their own measurements on how they would sort of classify themselves in terms of safety culture or safety maturity or safety climate, or however you want to define it. But, you know, there is a big difference in terms of doing nothing or doing the bare minimum to going above and beyond, you know, and that includes, you know, really caring for your people or being really innovative, really engaging in your teams. And then, you know, you've got everything in between. So I mean, depending on the type of business it is, you know, you might be okay sitting right in the middle where, you know, you meet your requirements, you know, and you might have some good practices in place on the ground. That might be quite fine. But for some businesses, especially, you know, if you want to be a sort of mid top tier construction company, or if you want to work for the mining companies, et cetera, you know, they're looking for mature safety systems. And a good way to assess that, in my opinion, I mean, one part of that is, you know, how does it stack up against a standard such as ISO 45001? Now, I'm not saying that's the answer, but it is a good indication of, does somebody have a good and robust management system? The other aspect of that is, you know, how effective is it on the ground? And what are the opinions of the people? And, you know, what sort of hazards, near misses, and incidents are coming through? And from all that information plus more, you know, you could probably get a good indication of where your organization sits in terms of safety, culture, maturity, climate, however you want to classify. And even that, when you start looking at those terms, you know, those are debated. Some people think it's a load of BS. There's no such thing as safety culture. And, you know, they're probably quite right. And I kind of tend to agree. Like, yeah, maybe it is just organizational culture, because to be honest, safety, it is just part of managing business, right? Like, to separate safety and say that safety is a thing, it's not really a thing. It's just helping you, like, it's looking after your people. It's managing your business, making sure that nothing bad happens. So, you know, I quite agree with that in many ways. But for some organizations, you know, if they really want to focus in on one area, like safety, you know, if they want to have an assessment undertaken or do some evaluation to get an understanding of, all right, where do we sit with safety? You know, what's the culture? What are the thoughts of our people? How do our management systems stack up, and, you know, on paper and in practice? You know, it might provide some benefit to them. You know, it's probably the ones like the zero harm, where, you know, those sort of slogans and that, as you know, that gets bashed a lot in the safety realm, you know, and for good reason or not. But, you know, there is arguments that, look, if you think it provides you benefit, if you've already have it, I mean, sometimes it's hard to just erase it. Yeah, zero harm, it's, you know, in most instances, it's not practical, right? Or it's not achievable. There's really no such thing as zero harm. Something's always going to happen somewhere. Yes, you want to avoid it. It's probably more of a, I don't know if you'd call it a vision, but it definitely shouldn't be a goal, because it'd be unrealistic. But, you know, I think some of that stuff, the shift maybe might be looking at preventing fatalities and life-altering injuries and illnesses, maybe. Although that's long-winded. So maybe that's what they mean by zero harm in some instances, is that, you know, maybe they're quite accepting that there'll be, you know, some first aid injuries, there might be some medical treatment injuries here and there. But, you know, for some of them, that might be what they're talking about. And without knowing, you know, a lot of times it's about the intent rather than the statement.
Yeah. I don't think, I mean, you're right, it does get poo-pooed quite rightly in safety circles. But perhaps it shouldn't just be thrown out, simply because if you take it as an aspiration or a value, but not a goal, not a KPI, not a target, any of that, if we separate that apart, it's a great aspiration. You know, that's what we would like to have. We would like to have world peace.
Correct. And I don't think there's anything wrong with the statement per se. I mean, mind you, sometimes people are, you know, against or these sort of things for their own personal benefit. You know, that there might be some good validity around it too. You know, if you look at Sydney Decker, for example, I know well, last I heard him speak, he was very against the zero harm. But he had some pretty classic real life examples of focusing on the wrong items of safety, which I totally understand. I think that's fantastic. And that's where a lot of time we do spend too much effort on low-level safety risk, for example. You know, and when we talk about compliance and things like that, you know, we start to go back to what we were talking about before. You know, if a safety officer is, you know, strictly doing compliance-based activities, which aren't out in the field looking at high-risk construction activities or high-risk activities in general, you know, the time spent may not be the time spent on the right area. And then, yeah, so if you go back to zero harm and that, yeah, it gets a bad rap. I wouldn't necessarily encourage an organization to utilize that terminology. And, you know, I don't like slogans and mottos and things like that. But, you know, if organizations think that that's what they need and there's a reason behind it, you know, as long as it gets the right communications, that the intent is clear and it provides some benefit, then I don't think it should inhibit anyone from utilizing that sort of terminology.
All right. Talk to me. What is Lobos advisory? What does it do?
Lobos advisory, we sort of try to focus on like three areas, and it's very generalized in that respect. One's safety consulting, being that safety is very complex and there's many aspects of safety. You know, put that in simple terms, it's safety consulting. So everything from, you know, strategy development of WHS management systems, all the way down to, you know, helping manage safety on the front line. And then the other sort of service stream is ISO certification. So on the safety, environment, quality areas, where we help organizations that not always trying to achieve certification, but sometimes they might just want a management system sort of aligned to those certificate or to those standards. So yeah, help clients in that area. And then the third sort of service stream is safety training / coaching. So helping organizations, you know, if they got a team managing safety or work that's obviously got some safety elements, you know, there's various, you know, gaps in knowledge. So it just depends on what that is. That it might be, you know, providing a training on, you know, safety fundamentals, safety principles, you know, the basics of how to manage safety through to, well, sorry, that the other aspect would be coaching, where, you know, if there's a young green safety officer advisor, it'd be providing some coaching / mentorship. So not only on the particulars of risk management, but just also on the approach as well. So it's just giving them some guidance to feel confident in the role and make sure that, you know, you're leading them in the right direction, where, you know, they're not coming in as a safety officer where they're writing up tickets and they've got their baton and they're, you know, catching people out. But it's more of that, you know, let's increase the educational awareness. Let's improve how we manage safety. Let's build some relationships with the people on the ground and let's get their inputs and views. And, you know, considering the legislative compliance requirements, clients requirements, internal requirements, let's factor that in. Let's factor what actually happens on the front line, and let's look at what our procedures say versus what we do. And, you know, let's work out where the gap is or non-compliance, and, you know, determine what do we need to do to continue forward in the, you know, the best approach, one for the people doing the work, but also the organization.
Excellent. Robert Allen, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you today, and I look forward to speaking to you again soon. But for now, we'll have to leave it there.
All right. Thanks, Tom. Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to Health and Safety Conversations with Tom Bourne. Until next time, stay safe and enjoy the rest of your week.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's stamps.com, code program.
Summer's just around the corner, so give your body the care it deserves with Osea's best-selling Andaria Algae Body Oil. Created by infusing Andaria seaweed in barrels of botanical oils, it leaves skin silky soft and glowing. Plus, it's clinically proven to improve elasticity and deeply moisturize without feeling greasy. It's safe, clean, vegan skincare. Get 10% off your first order at OseaMalibu.com with code GLOW, plus free shipping on orders over $60.